Hello, and you're very, very welcome to yet another episode of the Life Well Lived podcast. This is the show that accepts that no matter who you are and where you are in life, challenges are absolutely inevitable, and the best thing we can do is to equip ourselves with the tools to navigate those challenges and live whatever it is that amounts to our very own life well lived. My name is Shane Breslin, and my mission in my life's work, both in my day-to-day consulting business and with my writing, speaking, and this very podcast you're listening to right now, is to help guide people through those challenges so that they can know and fully embrace their own uniqueness and enjoy a life of vitality, fulfillment, and happiness. My guest in this episode of the show is an individual who I was introduced to by a mutual friend earlier this year with the words, "You need to know this guy. He could be a great guest for your podcast." And I think he was very, very right. Darren Gavin co-founded the Mental Health Guys blog and has been writing and speaking about mental health in Ireland and overseas for the past couple of years. And I've no doubt, having spent some time with him for this show, that he's just starting out on a journey that will positively impact very many people, many of them guys, in the months and years to come. In this conversation, we hear about Darren's mental health issues in childhood, how they went away for most of his teens and 20s before returning with a vengeance, and how he came out the far side of that and started to consider how he might shine a light on what so many people everywhere are going through almost every day. Invited by the prominent mental health campaigner Niall Breslin, no relation to yours truly, to write about his experiences, Darren started the Mental Health Guys blog and has opened doors and conversations in so many places with his words from there. We also chat about his experiences of the way mental health is treated in the workplace, how Darren divides his life into compartments, why he doesn't use the word failure, his new definition of success, and lots more. A very quick word about the audio here. There's a tiny amount of background noise a few times during this recording, but I really didn't think it was enough to prevent me from bringing this interview to you, and hopefully you'll feel that it doesn't negatively impinge on your experience too much. But enough from me for now. On to my conversation with Darren Gavin of the Mental Health Guys blog on all things mental health. Darren Gavin, it's great to have you on the podcast. Thanks so much for taking the time today.
You're more than welcome.
So tell me, Darren, the very first question, typically ask when I introduce people here is, what are you grateful for in life right now?
I'm grateful for the health of my four kids and my partner, Amy. I'm grateful for the things that we have, I suppose. We have a roof over our head and the fact that I have a job every day, etc. So grateful for the simple things in life.
Excellent. And what, looking forward, what are you most excited about right now?
I suppose I'm excited about some of the work that I'm involved with in the mental health space, and the fact that the conversation is starting to, although we're only scratching the surface, it's starting to become more topical and more front of mind for a lot of both organizations and individuals as well. So really excited about that. And obviously, as I mentioned, I have a young family, so I'm excited to see them develop and grow and achieve their own successes.
Excellent. Best luck with that and the family. I know from my own experience how busy that the young kids can keep us. So,
exactly. So yeah,
we're at either end of the boxing ring there, and we're kind of wishing each other on.
Yeah, exactly.
So tell me about the Mental Health Guys blog. Tell me kind of about its origins. Tell me, why you decided to put this together in the first place.
Yeah, I suppose I was out with a well-known mental health ambassador last year in Ireland, Niall Breslin, actually, your namesake. And we were talking about the mental health stuff that he's involved with. And he asked me around my own mental health experience and what I consider writing about it. And funny enough, I had started writing some information about a month before. And so I sent that on to him. And funny enough, the editor for A Lust for Life emailed me back and asked me, could they publish what I wrote? So that's kind of where it started, in the sense that it became a little bit more public. But outside of that, when I was a kid, I suffered anxiety, so much so that I would spend days kind of looking outside the window, maybe two or three days I wouldn't go outside because I was worried about potential things that might happen. And it was strange, I suppose, now looking back, that a 7, 8, 9, 10 year old would have those feelings. certainly in my mind. But I know that it's more commonplace than people realise. So that's kind of where it started. And then I started writing the blog last year, and I completed a number of articles now. And what we try and do is, myself and a friend of mine, Paul, he's kind of the IT side of it, but also he's got three children, I've got four, so life is busy. But we started putting articles together around, there's lots of information out there, and we started pulling some of that useful information and applying it to one article where people can read simplistic articles that are easy to decipher, easy to take in, and maybe take one or two steps that will help them and in a positive outlook tomorrow, or understanding maybe where they can go as regards support. But one thing I suppose, Shane, that we would say from the outset is that we're not psychologists, although I have a background in organization psychology, and I have a huge interest in the whole psychology of people and team dynamics, etc. And I'm lucky enough to work in the health and well-being space on a 9-to-5 basis on my daytime gig. So yeah, it's kind of all connected, I suppose. Studying organizational psychology as well perked a lot of my interest around how the brain can drive us on or drive us down or bring us along. So yeah, lots of things are connected, I suppose, over the last number of years.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll get into a little bit of the detail of kind of what you're doing on the blog and how that works and what the if you have a mission or ambition for the blog. But the conversation that you had with Niall Breslin, what did you guys chat about? Because Niall, no relation of my own, I have spoken to him very briefly in the not too distant past, but the way he spoke about this definitely helped me to speak about it as well a couple of years ago. So what was the conversation that you had with Niall around it? What had you been had you been experiencing different things that prompted that conversation in the first place?
Yeah, I suppose we were talking about mental health, and I kind of spoke up and said, these are the things that happened to me when I was a kid. And Niall is the first person I've ever come across that said to me, the exact same thing used to happen to me. And what that was is when I used to get into bed as a small kid. And it generally happened before either I was going to have a cold or a flu, or I was really worried about something. My bed would sink into the floor. And my room walls would get really, really big around me, and I'd feel the size of an ant, and that's the only way I can describe it to you. And my legs would feel really funny, like they've changed complete material makeup into dirt almost. So really strange thing for a 7 or 8 or 9 year old to experience. But he said to me, I used to experience the exact same thing, and it's the first time I've ever come across anybody that's experienced it like that. Then I heard obviously his conversation around his own experience as a young man and into adolescence, etc. And a lot of the things he talked about were very similar to what I had. And I suppose he made it really just mentioned he helped you, and he certainly helped me understand that it was in one sense more normal than I would have thought initially, and two, that it was okay to talk about it. And I suppose that's kind of what drove me on then to start writing a little bit more about it, and his encouragement as well from his team at A Lust for Life to kind of start writing about it as well, you know.
Can you put yourself back in that kind of as that 7, 8, 9, 10 year old? How did you feel back then? Did you feel there was something wrong? Did you feel there was something like how if you can recall that time? How were you feeling about things then?
Oh my goodness. It's almost like as well from a psychological point of view, it's like my brain has almost switched that feeling off, because it was so, the word I'd use to describe is terrifying. Lack of understanding, scared, all of those things, but also not saying to myself, why am I different? So I never thought that. I was an only child growing up, and I was very lucky. My mum was very open to talking to me about different things, etc. So I never felt I was different. But in the same vein, I didn't know what was going on, and I didn't know what was happening. As I said, the anxiety thing would kick in. I'd be walking home from school, and I'd be worried maybe who I might bump into, or I'd be worried about certain things that were coming up, but overly worried about school, etc. And I see a little bit of it in my daughter, my oldest daughter, in a sense that she does worry a little bit more than her brother, I would say, than her next in line, her brother. But so it was an element of scared and uncertainty, but certainly never felt that I was different, luckily enough.
Good. And how did this manifest kind of later in life? Were you able to kind of compartmentalize that as you grew older, or was there elements that kind of carried through into adulthood?
That's a really, really interesting point, and something I talk about when I'm involved in talking to individuals or groups about this. When I hit my teenage years, saying it disappeared, and I came across something recently where they talk about celebrities or sports people, etc., being at really high levels of a profession, and all of a sudden that stops. So take, for instance, Gary Speed and his profession, etc., and the struggles that poor guy went through over the years, etc. When they finished, I suppose, being in the limelight, and a lot of sports people talk about this, they couldn't find a sense of purpose or where do I fit in now. So for 20 odd years, over 30 years, I was at this level and I was a center of attention, and now I've kind of finished that, and for some people that can cause them to lose a sense of purpose or self-worth. So for me, going to secondary school, I actually found my sense of purpose and my sense of self-worth, because I ended up in with an in-group, as they say. So it kind of disappeared when I hit secondary school. And then myself and Amy met and we had kids. And Amy went through her own struggles when her sister passed away with post-traumatic stress disorder. So from the other person's point of view, from my point of view, trying to understand that was a challenge in itself, trying to understand someone else's mental health when you've never seen it before. So we went through a lot of challenging stuff. We obviously went to live abroad for a number of years, had a great time, and we're at a very, for want of a better word, we're in an always-on type lifestyle. So my job was going really, really well. Our lifestyle was phenomenal. We had great friends around us. We were always at something. And I think I reached a point in my late 20s, early 30s of burnout, Shane. So that manifested itself in early last year, a panic attack, a sense of worthlessness, a sense of not knowing where to turn, in a very dark place. So much so that I was Googling things like, does stress cause suicide? Although I knew it didn't, but I was very self-aware what was happening to me. And myself and Amy had a very honest conversation, and I said, right, you need to do something, as in start exercising more or go and see somebody. And I would always encourage people to go and see someone. But in 2013, I did actually go and see a psychologist around EAP with the employer I was with at the time. And that helped a lot. And you mentioned compartmentalizing. And I have to do that now. I have to compartmentalize my time with four young children and a busy life and a 9-to-5 gig, etc. So I will compartmentalize. Amy and the kids are here, and I don't like to put people in boxes, but that's the way I have to operate. And work is here and college is here, etc. And I open and close those when I need to. So exactly what you said, compartmentalizing has helped me immensely to manage the busy schedule of life. And I think what people sometimes forget is they feel that because they're not a celebrity or not an ex-rugby player, not an ex-sports star, that maybe their issues in life aren't as big as everybody else's. But in reality, everybody has stuff going on. It's okay to talk about it. And what we're trying to do at Mental Health Guys is get people talking about it and putting their hand up and asking for help.
And the panic attack you mentioned last year, and some of the other things that triggered you to kind of look elsewhere, to look for, to even question yourself or to look outside for help. Is there a pattern?
Well, what I would say is the first piece is in the Mental Health Guys, we're not psychologists, we're not medically trained as such, so we're not there to try and solve people's psychological issues. But certainly for me, there wasn't a pattern. For some people, I suppose, I've heard from other people who have had those instances that, yes, certain triggers set them off, or certain situations or whatever, or certain feelings. But certainly for me, it just came out of the blue, Shane. Now, came out of the blue in a sense that it just happened that morning. But before that, if I look back now in hindsight, I can see the things that led up to me getting there.
Yeah.
So an always on lifestyle. We had a lot of stuff going on before we went away. As I mentioned, Amy's sister passed away. We found out our house had pyrite, which is essentially the house is falling down. We got all of that fixed, but there were so many things that happened for us. And plus, we moved house 3 or 4 times in a 5-year period and had 3 babies and a 4th just last year. So there's a lot of stuff. And when you weigh up how busy life can be, unfortunately, sometimes it can lead to burnout if you don't take care of yourself. So no, there wasn't a pattern, but certainly I could see now what the lead up to it was.
Yeah, and I totally recognize all the kind of the list of kind of check boxes that you just reamed off there. I totally recognize a lot of those as well in terms of you know, house moves, job moves, family, the pressure that I guess we put ourselves under. Do you think that as men, do we expect too much of ourselves?
Well, I think in both sides of the sexes, so males and females, I think there is certain expectations put on ourselves, yes. And you know what, sometimes that's good to have an expectation so that we can achieve what we maybe set our minds to, etc. But also, there's a lot created around social media. And one of the reasons I got off kind of Facebook last year as a frequent user, now I would still use Messenger to communicate because I have friends around the world in different places that I still talk to, but certainly we produce on social media this idealistic life. So we see these people with these ideal lives, let's say in other countries or elsewhere around Ireland, and we go, oh God, my life isn't as good as that. And we underrate ourselves sometimes. And I think so there's pressures there, and there's obviously family pressures. Like a lot of people nowadays have pressure on them to, even if they don't have any children, have pressure on them to have a family, you know? So there's so many different pressures out there that I can understand why people get to a point of burnout. But I mentioned earlier on, the important piece is to take care of our physical health. And that's one of the things that helped me last year. I started running, and to tell you that I don't like running is probably an understatement. I never did. And I couldn't run more than 2 kilometers without stopping and being in a heap on the ground. Although I played soccer and Gaelic football over the years, I wasn't long distance running fit, and I'm glad to say I did the marathon then in October.
Congratulations. And did you enjoy the marathon?
Absolutely loved it. I ran for almost 6 hours. It took me to do it, but there was never a doubt in my mind that I wasn't going to complete that marathon. I was completing it from day one. I was doing it. And I have to say, the running piece, I was running later in the evening, which I don't recommend to everybody, but that's the time I have to run because I have a busy schedule with the kids at home, etc. But I was running at 10 o'clock at night or 9:30 and getting my kilometers in. And the opportunity, and I don't even listen to music and run because I find clouds my mind when I'm trying to think of things, but the opportunity to let your mind settle from the busy day that's been or the busy week that's been, I can see that now, how that helped me through some of the things I was trying to work out in my mind. And at 39 years old, in the midst of my busy life, it's important to take that time to kind of reaffirm what the important things are and work the week out, you know?
Yeah. I'm going to come back to the men, the male side. I totally get that there's mental health spectrum and that it affects both sexes without a doubt, but I'm 41, you're 39, I think you said. We're both, I'd still classify us as young men, right? Listen, I'm going to give us that.
We might be approaching 21.
Yeah, it is. So I'm going to come back to that in a second. But on the running thing, it is something that I have done that I discovered, I suppose, maybe 3-4 years ago. And it's an interesting thing that I've found. And I wonder if you're on this journey as well. Do you still, when it comes to running now, are you enjoying it? You do enjoy the actual act of running now?
No, I wouldn't say that. I enjoy how I'm going to feel after. So yes. I enjoy the fact that I'm doing something that's going to make me feel fantastic the following day or that night. So I think it's that piece. I have to say that the running part of it, the getting from the front door back to the front door and around where I live is just part of the process of feeling good.
I totally understand it. It's like something I discovered, and I've only discovered this maybe in the last 4 to 5 months, and I'm running about 3 years or so. I'm running kind of semi, not even serious, but like I finished playing Gaelic football about 18 months ago. Or less than 2 years ago. So effectively since the start of last year, running has been my go-to exercise. And for the first 2 to 3 years, when I had my runners, I was doing the park runs, I was, you know, backing all the runs. I hated, like really, really hated the hour or two before I would run. You know, I never looked forward to it. I didn't enjoy the run. But after the run, I felt amazing. Like, it was always worth. So very similar to what you just said, it was always worth it because of how I felt afterwards. And even in like, I've been thinking. I heard Joe Rogan talking recently about the 5 minutes after you do a workout, and that as your heart rate kind of returns to normal, and your body is just feeling amazing. Like that, those 5 minutes are the best part of my day, without a doubt. Yeah. Now, when I get to the end of a run, whatever it is, I have discovered that I in the last 3 to 4 months, which has stunned me and surprised me, is that I'm actually enjoying the act of running now, and I'm actually looking forward to it a lot more. So I've kind of have that kind of 3 points of that triangle, which feels kind of magic, because I'd never expected to actually enjoy it. I was like, it felt like torment. and I enjoyed having done it, but to get to a stage where I'm actually enjoying being out there, and I'm kind of taking even little detours that adds a 500 meters or a kilometer or two onto the run. It's like that's a major surprise to me. So and it has been so good for me in terms of that. I know that if I go 2, 3, 4 days without doing something that kind of gets my heart rate up and gets me sweating. If I go 2, 3, 4 days without that, I can feel my blood starting to slow, and I can feel everything kind of having an effect. So it's interesting that we've had a similar experience.
Yeah, and it's probably the same for a lot of people. I think we're lucky in that sense that we found an outlet. And I think for a lot of people, especially in the mental health space, it's about finding that outlet, what makes them happy, whether that's spending time with friends that they can actually be themselves with and don't have to wear a mask or pretend they're someone else, or whether it's going for a walk in their locality, in nature, etc. There was a TV program on RTE recently about the benefits of living near the sea, and I didn't get to see it, but I saw some clips of it, and it sounded really interesting around people going sea swimming, etc. So there's definitely a connection from a nature point of view to how we feel, and there's a reason why when we go for a hike or when we go away on holidays and we get to spend time in that sort of an atmosphere, that we do feel better when we come back. So it doesn't necessarily have to be running, as we both said, but it's important that people do find their outlet that makes them feel good.
Interesting. Like I think for very many people, just like you mentioned about hiking, walking, even walking slowly. I think they do so much sitting, whether that's at work, on the couch. We do so much kind of sedentary stuff in our lives now. And I think that anything we can do to but like body movement, but also just changing our viewpoint and our perspective and change what we're looking at. I think all of that has a big positive impact. So I think that whatever, like moving, that's why travel, I think, is important for a lot of people. It's just like seeing different things is good for our heads and our minds.
It's interesting that you say that. My father-in-law said to me when I was leaving to go and live abroad, he sent me a message saying, if life was a book and you hadn't traveled, you've only turned one page. Yeah, or something to that effect. It's a famous quote from somewhere. I'm not sure where it's from, but it's interesting that you talk about the travel piece as well, because it is important. But not everybody can afford that either. So certainly abroad. So as I said, I think it's important just to find your happy place and to really exhaust as much as you can and spend as much time in those happy places as you can.
And I think, and even just giving yourself the benefit of the doubt that you can actually experience that happiness, that it's not beyond you, that actually it's a human right. I've been meditating on this over the last while. I believe that happiness is a human right, and the happiness is the point of almost everything. But I think that we're in a lot of cases due down to clever marketing and manipulation and all that, we're defining happiness wrong is what I'm kind of working on and working towards. But everybody deserves that happy place. Everybody deserves to experience that. And like to do without guilt as well, to experience without guilt. Because I think in a lot of cases, when we're happy, it's almost like, you know, George is like, you know, like we have to pay the price for this at some point. We have to the drudgery of whatever it is just to deserve the happiness that we have. And I don't think that's the right way to look at it either. On the male thing. So as I mentioned, like both of us are in around the same age. We both have young families. We both have a lot going on. What are you hearing from men in what you've written on the blog? And it's Mental Health Guys, so I'm assuming it's written by two guys, you and Paul. What are you hearing from people? What feedback are you getting in terms of kind of the whole spectrum or the landscape of particularly men and mental health?
I suppose I'm hearing some things around, I suppose, the farming type background, so that there's not enough conversation going on there, and let's say old rural Ireland and in farming communities, etc., because it's sometimes seen as a weakness or a negative to talk about your mental health, etc. So I'm hearing that a lot, actually. I'm hearing that typically guys wouldn't have spoken up over the years, again, because of weakness or not wanting to show that vulnerability is a big piece for people. I watched a great TED Talk recently by Brené Brown on vulnerability, shame, and courage. I don't know whether you've seen it. It's really, really interesting. And so I find that sometimes we're in fear of showing our vulnerability. And it probably goes back to historic times, etc. But I think nowadays it can happen across both, obviously. But I think they're the pieces I'm hearing about. And speaking to a few gentlemen last week, actually, when I was away delivering a talk, one of the gentlemen kind of almost apologized for talking about the guy piece. He said, look, I don't want to just say that it's guys versus girls. And I was like, no, that's okay. No apology needed, you know. And I did think it is important that we recognize both sides of the mental health side of things for males and females. But yes, historically, there was a problem. I think it's getting better. And I think more people, be they guys or girls, need to stick their hands up and say that it's okay. Number one, it's okay for me to ask for help. Because think about this, Shane, if we were in work tomorrow and someone came along to us and said, do this job that you've never done before, our first thing would be, well, hang on a minute, you can't expect me to do this if I've never done it before. I'm going to need help. However, in life, for instance, I'll be a first-time dad of an 11-year-old girl in November. I've never had an 11-year-old girl before. I don't know what that's like. But for some reason, maybe I won't ask people for help, because I think, you know what, my problems and the issues that I've had and the stress that I've had in my life are not extreme, thank God. And I was never in a really, really, really awful place in my mind compared to some of the stories that you hear out there. But I still think that I was lucky to be aware of myself as much as I was, and to notice where it was going or where it potentially could have gone. So I suppose in summary and all that, I would say that it's okay to ask for help no matter what's happening in your life. It's okay to go to people and say, you know what, I'm not sure about this. And if you look at some of the top organizations around the world, the CEOs, they would have psychologists and psychiatrists and retainers almost to help them navigate life. So people don't generally get to those high positions or succeed at what they want without asking people for help. I think it's important to be able to ask others for help. And 99% of people, if you say, can you help? They'll say, I absolutely will if I can. What do you need?
Yes, completely. And it is like when I'm trying to kind of cast my mind back to definitely for me, one of the big drivers, I think, for me was the desire not to be seen as weak. And like I was the world's best at projecting phantom thoughts into other people's heads. You know, like that I could see what they were thinking of me, even if that was completely wide of the mark.
I get it. I totally get it. That's why I'm laughing, not laughing at what you did.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people do that, right? So
yeah, completely. And I think as men, sometimes we're our own worst enemies when it comes to that. Like I think it is like this kind of, I don't know what you might call it. Like it's like the old strong silent type was kind of somebody who just kind of got on with it and just kind of shouldered everything. What would you like when you think of kind of what male strength or what a strong man is in 2019?
I admire a guy who can be. I enjoy genuine people a lot. So I enjoy a genuine individual. They genuinely have good intentions. I admire vulnerability, as I just mentioned a moment ago. I admire the fact that someone's not afraid to show their emotion. Myself and Amy talked about this recently, that having lived in abroad and having been involved in a lot of different cultures, living in North America, there's huge amount of different cultures there. So you get to experience how different cultures act. And if you look at the male, I suppose, side of it there, males in different cultures act very differently as well. And I have to say, I enjoy the fact that I found in North America, especially, males, in where I was anyway, were more in touch with their emotional side versus right now Irish guys. And that's a very generous comment, and not everybody's like that, but myself and Amy had a discussion just only recently to say that we do find that we found in North America people were more open with their emotions than they are here. And so I met a gentleman last week actually, and he talked to me about one of his friends going through some relationship stuff. He didn't obviously go into the detail, but he said some of his other friends are saying to this guy, don't worry about it. You're strong. Remain strong. You're a strong guy. Don't worry about it. So although they mean well, and I get that, and we all don't know what to say. I wouldn't know what to say to people sometimes. They tell me some of the stuff they have going on. But what he said to me was, so already they're putting a pressure on this gentleman to say, you're strong. So he leaves that conversation saying, I have to be strong for everybody else because they think I'm strong.
Yeah.
You know, so I think that happens a lot. And I do think, as I've said a number of times now, I think it's okay and important to show our vulnerability sometimes and to let that out. And I suppose we don't know what goes on behind closed doors and how upset people can get, etc. But I think the only thing that we can do is say to people, if you need to talk, I'm here to listen. We don't even have to contribute. We can just be the sounding board. We can just listen, just open our ears, be on the other side, and allow that person to feel confident in the fact that they're able to tell us some stuff that's going on and get it off the chest. Because you know as well as I do, as soon as you get things out, it often can reduce the size of the mountain that you thought was ahead of you substantially.
100%. Like the two things you mentioned there that I think are just really, really critical, and just to underline them again is the talking piece and just the act of actually speaking. Like the way I described it to different people in the past is that an honest conversation, and that is a kind of a two-way conversation, like as in, if I talk honestly and the person that's on the other end that might just be listening, but that they're bringing honesty to it as well, that they're not just kind of hiding or judging anything, that they're bringing some honesty and integrity and openness as well. That honest conversation is like one of the most powerful drugs that I've ever experienced, without it, like probably the most powerful drug. Incredible high to be open and honest and to talk about that. It is an amazing experience, an amazing feeling. And the other thing you said was about being genuine, or like that you admire and respect genuine people. It is like one of the most valuable things I did was about exactly two years ago that I took the time to do a personal values. I was encouraged to do a personal values exercise, and I worked out what my own personal values were and what were the non-negotiable things and what were the things that that there might be a bit of discussion around or a bit of compromise around, but what were the 2, 3, 4 things that I just said that were just non-negotiable values for me, and I didn't want to do anything that was endangering those. And it was the first time in my life I'd ever done that, and I realized why I had really, really, really hated some of the jobs I'd been in, because they were completely at odds with my personal values. And I encourage anybody to take that, and it's like really a pen and a piece of paper, and just kind of like what are the things that I value in my life, and when I think about things, what are the things that I, what are the values that I have up there as non-negotiable? And everybody has different things that they value, but yours are absolutely valid for you, and mine are absolutely valid for me, and everybody has that different combination of stuff that once you know that, then you can be genuine in the knowledge that you know yourself at a more deeper level than you have before, possibly.
And allow yourself to get into that space as well. You have to allow yourself that time, I think.
Yes, it doesn't happen overnight. And I think it's like anything, like all these things is a journey. And like, you know, I think mental health is a journey. I think
it is.
I think like life is a journey, and we're like, you know, we're all going to fail most of the time, like, you know. And I think
but that's funny that you say that fail is not necessarily a word I believe in very much. It's interesting that you say that. And that's something I learned, by the way, through, if you want to put it like that, failure. But I started to view, and these are small things I did to have a more positive outlook. So instead of viewing things as a failure, I'll give an example of why this was done. I had an annual review and work about 6 or 7 years ago, and I got the document back from my manager at the time, and I sat down, and the first thing I did was take out a highlighter and highlight all the negative things. Like, who does that, right?
Like the fail side of things, the definition of the word fail, I see failing as a good thing, but failure, that word failure is a completely, like, I absolutely, like, that, because that implies something that's, you know, finite and complete and non-negotiable. But I am happy that we can try things in the knowledge that we're going to fail most of the time. But the word failure, I do have a problem with, so I totally get where you're coming from there. So on the blog, Darren, the mental health guys, where can people find out more about it? Where can people go to read the blogs? And if you have an ambition or a mission for the blog, what is that?
So the blog page is www.mentalhealthguys.com. And then the blog information, some of the articles that we put together, is available on A Lust for Life. So if you search A Lust for Life, Mental Health Guys, it's in there as well. And then we have a Twitter page at Mental Health Guys, without the U in guys, because you can only have 14 or 15 letters in your handle.
Yeah.
I thought it made sense just to take out the U because it still looked the same. And I suppose the ambition really for the blog is that if it helps one individual, Shane, with some information that might help either their understanding, or they can share it with a friend, etc. That's the ambition. If it helps one person, then I'm happy that we've, I suppose, got that conversation continuing, because the conversation has started. And even to look back at a year ago, where it's come, as I said, I'm lucky enough to work in the health and wellbeing space on a 9-to-5 basis. And so to see where that conversation around mental health specifically has come in a 12-month period is really, really great. But I think there's still a lot to do as well.
Yeah, without a doubt. Best of luck with all that. You speak as well. You've spoken on some stages. Do you speak about mental health and what it will be?
Yeah, we do. Yeah. So I've travelled abroad to do some speaking sessions, and I've done some speaking sessions in Ireland as well, and I have a few more lined up for the rest of this year. But really, I suppose the speaking sessions are a little bit about the personal story. There's a little bit of interaction in it. There's a bit of fun in it as well. And I suppose the aim of it is to leave, when I talk about what we're here to do, it's to help reduce stigma around mental health and increase that conversation, and to leave with maybe a more open mind than we had before. So,
You mentioned the word stigma. We haven't spoken about that before. How do you define it, or in what way have you seen stigma kind of manifest itself in your experience or in the world?
Certainly in the workplace I've seen it, and I've even overheard conversations over the years where someone might have been out with a stress-related illness, etc., and I've heard other people say, well, we can't necessarily put them forward for promotion. I just think and I haven't heard that in recent times, by the way. This would have been probably longer than 5 or 6 years ago, and I don't think you would necessarily hear that as often now. Although I do know there's still stigma out there, but certainly that's one of the very blatant stigma pieces that I would have heard. And then there's also the misperception that someone with a mental health issue is the words that people use, right? So mad, crazy, silly, ridiculous, don't want to hang around with them. Those sort of things are just, there's no room for that sort of stuff anymore, because I think you mentioned earlier on the mental health spectrum. And again, I'm not medically trained, so I don't know what that looks like per se, but certainly we all have mental health, good, bad, or indifferent. And I think it's important that we look after ourselves and each other, because especially from a workplace point of view, we spend a lot of time in work. And it's important that's a place we can go and bring our, I said at the start, and bring our whole selves to work. So I think that's all really important in helping reduce that overall stigma that exists. And I suppose people need to ask themselves, if someone came into work with a broken leg or a sore arm or a sore back, would we rush over and ask them, do they want a cup of tea? If there's something they need, can we help? But will we do the same on the mental health piece? And only people can answer that for themselves, you know?
I remember one boss I had going back a few years. It is a few years ago, but it's not in the dim and distant past either. But there was one of my colleagues took some time off. It was like it looked on the outside like burnout, or certainly maybe even depression or anxiety. But there was some he clearly hit a wall in what he was trying to do, and he took some time off to get better. I heard the boss talking about him one day, saying that don't mind him, he has issues. And I was like, it was just something that it really didn't impress me. And it was really something that was like, you know, so certainly the workplace is one of those areas. And when it comes to stigma, I felt really positive in terms of, I've had nothing but positive feedback really. In terms of kind of in public and with my friends and family. But certainly the workplace is a challenge, and it's a place that I have been in for the last 2 to 3 years. I'm self-employed and freelancing. So I don't have that 9 to 5. But yeah, I remember that definitely. And I experienced that. So you're still in that 9 to 5 in terms of workplace well-being. You mentioned about the organizational psychology background and your interest in psychology. What's the status play, the state of play right now when it comes to kind of workplace well-being?
I'm starting to see it a lot more, obviously, and given we mentioned my 9 to 5 gig, although it's not 9 to 5, it can be kind of long hours or short days. It really depends on the week. But certainly organizations are really embracing it. Certainly we're finding that across Ireland and even globally. Like when I worked abroad now, when I worked in Canada, God, I could expense things like runners. So if I was buying a pair of shoes and they were going to enhance my health and well-being, then I could submit the receipt through work, you know. And I think what it all comes down to is preventative stuff. So if we can help prevent someone getting to a point of burnout by helping them either get screening done or go for their consultations or take part in a health and well-being seminar at work or a wellness event, well, then that all feeds into a much more, I personally think, by the way, a much more engaged workforce. And there's also a value add back for the employee then as well, that if my organization are going to invest in my personal health. And that is an investment, remember, because if they do invest in the personal health of their employees, so just mentioned, they get so much more back. And studies around the world have probably proven that where there's a health and well-being program, or where there is wellness events, or where there's engagement with the employees, they get a little bit more productivity. So I see it moving in the right direction, absolutely. And by the way, this has happened probably in the last 5 to 8 years, that has really, really ramped up in activity.
Yeah. And have you seen any? I've noticed a little bit of lip service paid sometimes that there's programs because it's almost a box that needs to be ticked, or we need to be seen that we're doing something this and we're taking it seriously. But in reality, they might not be making it easier or taking it really seriously for employees. Have you noticed any of that, or are you satisfied that on the whole, most businesses are taking this really seriously?
I have to say, in general, I think most businesses are taking it seriously. I'm sure that side of things probably still exists, but certainly from my experience, I've seen businesses taking it seriously, and even the fact that. And when I talk about taking it seriously, even the fact that they're meeting to discuss the health and well-being of their employees, even the fact, if you look around the organizations now, they have health promotion officers and they have comp and Ben's HR representatives. They have employee engagement, culture and well-being representatives. So certainly on the whole, in general, I think they're all making the health and well-being footprint more definitive in their organizations. There's lots of ways to go with other organizations, but I think on the whole, they are making a genuine effort. And because the tide is going that way too. So as an employee, it's an employee market nowadays, and employees do expect to have, I suppose, well-being and an interest from their employer in the employee's well-being. They do expect it. You can see it from some of the bigger organizations with gyms on site, etc. And some of the organizations I would go into, they've healthy snacks in the kitchen. So it's not more chocolate Mars bars, etc. in the vending machine. It's apples and oranges and fruit and fresh food and all that sort of stuff. And some of them connect their canteens and their kitchens with their wellbeing program as well. So there's lots of really, really good stuff happening out there.
That's great. That's great. It's great to hear. It's fantastic to hear. It's a good, and I do think it's still in its infancy. And I think that, like, the world can only be a better place when so many employers are taking this really seriously and kind of, and yes, they will get more. It's not even getting more. They will get better contributions from their employees if they're taking that side of things seriously, I believe. It's been fantastic talking to you, Darren.
Congratulations. I'm delighted to be able to do it.
That's great. And congratulations on everything you've been doing, on just starting these conversations, which, you know, with the conversations you've started have led to this conversation between me and you. And there's no doubt it's going to lead to other conversations down the line. So congratulations on all of that. And I wish you the very, very best. If I can finish with a couple of really, really short questions.
Absolutely.
We spoke about failing and failure earlier on. On the flip side of that, what about success? How do you measure success? Do you think about it at all?
Oh, I do. And I suppose my measure of success now at almost 40 is different to my measures of success at maybe 21 or 22. So I had this conversation with my father recently, who you met at some events that you're at. But certainly at 21 or 22, I was chasing the big house, the nice house, the holiday every year, the fancy car, and I had and the higher salaries, etc. And now I chase happiness, which we talked about earlier on, and that happiness or success for me looks like being present with my children, singing with my kids for an hour in the evening to greatest hits of the 80s, like nobody's watching, and who cares if I can't sing? They have a great time enjoying themselves and their health and my health. And look, I know that over time and over lifetimes there are health issues that come into play for families, etc., but I think the more you embrace the present, the more you're able to deal with those things. So I think feeling like I'm present is certainly a measure of success. And I only talked about this to someone recently. When the time comes for us to leave this life and enter our next, whatever that might be, if I have the people that are important to me around me, then that was success.
I can't think of a better place to finish than that. And I'm going to leave it there. So Darren, Gavin, it's been fantastic talking to you, and thanks so much, and continued success in everything you're working on.
Thanks for the opportunity. Appreciate it, Shane.
Shane here again. A really, really quick word from me before I let you go. Thanks so much for listening all the way to the end. For starters, you are the grade A listener, which I'm delighted to have you here. I'm delighted to have you listen to the whole show. If you got something out of it, I'd be so, so grateful if you could share it in whatever social media, email, at the bus stop, wherever it is. If you can talk about this podcast, the Life Well Lived podcast interview with Darren Gavin from the Mental Health Guys blog, I'd be very, very grateful to help spread the word. If you want to find some older episodes of the podcast, this one is number 17, I think, 17 or 18. All the rest are on my website, shanebreslin.com. So if you visit that, shanebreslin.com, there's a link there for podcasts. You'll be able to find them there. And if you want to listen every week, whenever I publish a new episode, find it in iTunes, in Apple Podcasts, in Stitcher, wherever you listen to podcasts. I've probably butchered, I'm not even sure does iTunes fully do it anymore. Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, wherever you listen to podcasts, punch in Life Well Lived podcast and you should find this. Hit subscribe and all the episodes will pop into your device as I upload. So thanks once again for listening all the way to the end of this show. I'm delighted that you have taken the time, and I'm really, really grateful, and I'll see you again soon. Take care. Bye-bye.